I've been talking about not clinging to erudition. And I want to give a little background on the subject. Whenever one speaks of anything, one ends up giving a one-sided picture. And in speaking about not clinging to erudition, you can sometimes seem as if one is saying that there is of necessity a kind of war going on between the head and the heart, or that in order to really trust in the heart and listen to the heart, learn to follow one's deepest spiritual instinct, there has to be a kind of rejection of intellect. But of course, you know, we can't help it. We have a brain, and it's not in itself a problem. And of course, human beings have, compared to many other animals, have very developed brains. And it's really the use that we make of the brain that, and trying to make the brain do the work that can only be done by the heart, and I'm thinking here of the heart with a capital H, not the physical heart, obviously, the Buddha nature, that constitutes the problem. Whether this is always clear or not, when one's speaking of it, it is, you know, hard for me to tell, but so I thought I'd talk a little bit more about what the kind of underlying kind of problem always in the background is, and really how we go about making the transition from overly depending upon the brain to the brain taking its rightful place and being made use of by the eternal. First of all, we have to ask ourselves, well, you know, how did we ever get in a place where we were putting so much faith in our brain, in our thoughts, and we're so relatively unaware of our spiritual intuition? And while this certainly has cultural aspects, as Rim Master points out in the first section of Zen is Eternal Life, you know, Westerners are trained, virtually brainwashed from the time they're little children, to put a high value on intellect and to ignore their instinct, their intuition. You think about nowadays, even little children in nursery school and kindergarten are being forced more and more into a kind of intellectual mode. And they wonder why all the little children are so distressed, or so many of them are so distressed and unhappy and kind of frantic. But it goes beyond culture. It goes back to the, and it goes beyond our, you know, family upbringing. It goes back beyond this lifetime. It's hard to overly, I mean, it's hard to generalize, but so often it's the case that someone thought they were doing the right thing and then got a nasty surprise. Maybe they were doing the right thing, if right and wrong even applied, but they still got a nasty surprise and judged themselves very severely. And often the implication of that self-judgment is, well, if I just knew more, if I had my act more together, you know, then this wouldn't have happened. And so often that needing to know more then goes to intellect. If I gather more information, if I can analyze things better, that's often the practical readout. If not in that lifetime, then in a future life. You see. So, one way to put it, thinking that we're going to do a better job, we unknowingly hobble ourselves. Thinking that we're going to walk more freely and more with more assurance, more certainty, we actually hobble ourselves. Making it more difficult to actually hear that inner voice. And this always results in a kind of insistence. And the kind of insistence I'm talking about in these in this present series of talks is the insistence on intellectual clarity and intellectual understanding. In general, as a general thing, insistence, which is a manifestation of clinging, necessarily leads to suffering. You know, it ain't going to work, in other words. And there's a good reason why it's not going to work, because it's not the right route to go. So the suffering is going to show one that it's not the right route. There will always be a sense, while one is trying to live from the head, there will always be a sense of something missing. There will always be a sense of something lacking. There will always be a sense of something just out of reach. You know that kind of feeling? I remember like when you were solving problems in math and that kind of thing, and you knew there was a solution, you just couldn't quite get it. Well, translate that into spiritual terms. That's the problem of trying to make the poor old brain do what it was never meant to do. The Buddha nature cannot be apprehended. The deepest truth cannot be apprehended that way. You're talking about apples and oranges, you know, two different things. You might say apples and broccoli or something, because it's, you know, the quote knowing of the spirit is more a matter of love than a matter of knowledge. And it cannot be encapsulated by the adequately expressed by the word love either. There is no word for it. Words aren't the issue here. So it is, we belong to it, we're part of it, that is enough. You know, he is not, I am not him, he is all of me. That is enough. The fact that the brain don't get it doesn't matter. While it matters that the brain doesn't get it, one has a big problem. Because one keeps trying to force the brain to get it, and it was never meant to get it. That does not mean that the brain does not have a proper role. Of course it does. Like the whole rest of our life, every aspect of our body, every aspect of our mind has a use, a proper use. When the Eternal's in the driver's seat and we're not fighting it, we're not trying to take the Eternal's place, then our intellect can be used properly, concepts can be used properly, and words can be used properly. guidance for that use is coming from something deeper than a karmically generated insistence. It's coming from the natural activity of Buddha nature manifesting through the vessel, through the vehicle of our life, in all of its aspects, body and mind. Through thought, through speech, through bodily action, you name it. Now I want to tell a couple of stories on myself that I've told them before, but I'll just, you know, often it's just in an individual life that one can see how the transition happens. From the time I was a little child, I had a strong sense that I don't know how to put it, that God is, that there, and a longing to do something. I couldn't possibly put into words as a little child in relationship to God. That's very common with little children. You know, I think it's a natural, intuitive sense of Buddha nature there somewhere. It doesn't matter that the words that one learns that apply to it or the concepts don't matter so much. It's just what is in there. And I had a religious upbringing of sorts. Then as I got older, when I became a teenager, I then began gradually to break loose from that particularly narrow upbringing and was on the hunt for something else. And so in the process, for a while, I thought I became, if not an atheist, at least an agnostic by the time I was about 20. I never thought of myself as an atheist. And it's interesting that during the period I thought of myself as an agnostic, which is someone who feels they don't know whether God exists or not, but is keeping us at least somewhat open mind with regard to the fact. I was still doggedly searching, but I was searching by an intellectual means. So I ended up studying philosophy. I ended up studying, trying to approach religion through philosophy, which doesn't work very well, actually. But at least it got me back, you know, at least reading people's ideas about religion. And when I was in college, I was particularly drawn to Matthew Arnold and Tolstoy. Matthew Arnold was an English poet and writer, essayist, in the Victorian era. And Tolstoy, of course, the great Russian novelist, who became quite a kind of religious leader in his own idiosyncratic way, was a major influence on Gandhi, for example, and through Gandhi on Martin Luther King and the like. Both of these people were reacting against a more literal view of scriptures in Christianity and looking to the life of a kind of idealized life of Jesus for some kind of inspiration and sense of guidance, and advocating a compassionate kind of grounded spiritual life. As an alternative to more dogmatic kind of religion. And it's interesting, I was drawn to these people at this time because it's just kind of the stage I was trying to find in myself. But by the time I left college, this had all started to come unglued. And particularly after the death of my brother when I was a junior in college, I was getting inwardly more and more desperate. So when I left college, I needed a real break, so as many of you know, I hitchhiked to South America, which I wouldn't advocate nowadays. It was dangerous enough then, frankly. And I was walking down this road in Nicaragua one day, right near the border of Costa Rica. And I just spent several days on a beach being kind of both scared and just very much alone. And mentally, walking down that road, I picked up, it's hard to describe this, but I packed up all my book learning, put it in a mental lump, and I threw it away walking down this road. Kind of like I'd reached a limit. And I'd never heard of this kind of thing before. I knew nothing about renunciation or anything. I knew nothing about Buddhism. I just was fed up with trying to figure things out. Didn't mean it stopped me entirely, but it was a major step for me. And it was a necessary step. And not too long after that, while living in Colombia, that I started running into Buddhist teachings, and then I was ready for it. And Buddhism started to make sense to me then. And what little encounter I'd had with Buddhism before had made no sense to me, really. Only intellectual sense. This has started making heart sense to me. Talking about suffering, talking about the cause of suffering, talking about the liberation from the cause of suffering. This was making sense to me. This I knew I needed. Though not long after that, then I became a monk. And not long after that, I started training with the Reverend Master. But I remember, and I know these are stories I've told before, but to me, they stand out as key points in my effort to find something deeper than the brain. I remember when we do the Jodo ceremony with our master, that I would try to go up with no thought in my mind and try to let something come out. And I don't think I'd been told to do this, but it's just like maybe someone did something about this, but I wanted to try to let something come out that was deeper than my brains, in a way even deeper than my experience. And I would make the biggest ass of myself sometimes doing it. Come out and blurt out something that's like really left field. No one's judging one at that point. I wouldn't say something rude or anything, but so often it would be this kind of blurting out of this tension in some form. One of my fellow monks years later told me it just didn't make sense to him. I didn't make sense. And I can understand that. In a way, it was more than trying to ask a question. It was trying to let something out that was just deeper than anything I knew with my head. Then I'll tell another little story that I haven't told myself. That when Reverend Master started talking during 76 and after 1976, when she started really talking about listening to the eternal, I never remember speaking in that way before, really talking about hearing the voice of the Lord of the house or anything. I would actually kind of sit there and try to actually hear the voice of the Lord of the house, like I was going to hear a voice or something, you know. I have to say, by the way, I have heard a voice a few times, but not when I was trying to. I've never heard a darn thing when I was trying to. I'd never heard a darn thing when I was trying to. Nothing. Zero. because I didn't know how to not try. So I'd kind of sit there trying to hear something and thinking there's going to be something wrong with me. She described doing it and I don't hear nothing. And sometimes I wonder if people hearing me are doing the same thing and being equally frustrated. Till finally I just gave up on that. And there was a number of years when I didn't ask for help in a conscious way, and I didn't try to hear anything, and I just meditated as best I could and kind of muddled through daily life. And at times got very confused and went through a period of 7 years of doubt and confusion that started out kind of dramatically, but then most of the time was not so bad, but then gradually got eventually very bad and very difficult. But see, I didn't realize at the time, and I don't know if I think Rim Master recognized it. This kind of going through this period of great doubt was the very consequence of what I've been trying to do, of course, if you think about it. It was a reorientation that's so deeply disturbing, unsettling, that it starts exposing all kinds of the deep karmic roots of one's confusion and one's suffering. And it also is just, you just feel like, I told her master, sometimes I feel like I'm going crazy. She said, "You're not going crazy, friend. She's just going through a difficult period." You know, I'm usually describing someone really torn between head and heart. So if you think that I don't have sympathy for people going through that, I do, but just like her master couldn't do much for me in that period, I can't do anything much for them either. We have to go through what we have to go through. It's only in more recent years that I look back upon it and say, well, of course. There I was asking for it, wasn't I? You know, unknowingly, I was asking for it. I want to hear the voice of the Eternal. Well, then, you know, there's that part that you don't budget for, which is, well, there's this price you're going to have to pay, buddy. You've got this karma that's all this, you've got this external orientation. It's got to get reoriented. And this is after a first Kensho, a classic first Kensho. But that doesn't make it easy. And it's really not until we have to put in the context. I've been a monk now, you know, for most of my life, for over 35 years now. But it's really not until less than 20 years ago that the, you know, nickel started to really drop into the slot. And it's only in the retreat 98-99 that the real way for me personally to do the asking and the listening really manifested in my experience. And of course, it's not a method. And at the same time, there's points. It's kind of like in those five aspects of meditation that I was given. I cannot say that I didn't come up with them. I was given them. It's like the Eternal saying, you've always been wanting to do this. Yeah, you finally turned things over to me in the surrender, which I think of as a surrender with a capital S and with a great in front of it with a capital G, because it was so complete. You finally really surrendered. So now I can take my proper place in your life. And here's what you need to do. You know, do these things here. Do this. And of course, all of those things presume as their background meditation. Five aspects of meditation, that's the way it came up for me. They all presume that you're working at meditating. So You know, remember to ask for help. Remember to open your heart to the Eternal and to put it on the altar when you're trying to understand something, you're trying to do something. You know, remember to let go and release it to the Eternal. Remember to wait patiently and don't try to, you know, hear it. Don't try to hear it. Entrust it into the hands of the Eternal. Don't try. Wait patiently and keep listening while you're waiting. Keep listening. And then when the green light goes on, that's how I think of it these days, the green light goes on and the way opens up before you, then follow decisively and with certainty and with confidence. And my whole training since 98-99, since that period, has been working on this. And I could go through a whole bunch of ways in which I've really blown it in my own mind since then, at times where I didn't do that and really paid for it. But that's good too, because it reinforces, okay, so I forgot to ask. Or I forgot to put it on the altar, you know. I forgot to wait. I can point to different things I've done in the last 10 or 11 years where, well, on that one I didn't wait long enough, you know. I didn't really wait till I heard. You know, the green light didn't go on fully on that one. I acted too soon. On that one I forgot to ask for help. On that one I didn't put it on the altar. So, but of course, the ones that need to stand out are the ones where you didn't get it right. But then there's all the times when I did get it right. But you don't need to concentrate on them, because if you got it right, that's good enough. It's said in Christianity, always bear your sins in mind. Well, you can take that in a kind of guilty direction, and that's not helpful. You can also take it just in a direction, you know, remember what it's like to blow it. And then keep working it, getting it right. When you get it right, you don't need to worry about it because you got it right. I don't know if I quite express what I think about that, but it's like it's the teaching that comes from our experience is perfect, really. Mostly we need to attend to the areas where we didn't get it right. So what I've tried to describe from my own experience is just a few places that stand out of training in making that transition from over-dependence on the head to the head becoming a willing tool of the heart. Then it can be an excellent tool. And generally, I understand that I'm viewed as being someone, and I view myself as being someone who's pretty good at intellectual clarity, at expressing things clearly and thinking of things clearly when it's good to do so, when it's needed. But now I know something I didn't used to know, and that is that it's on a if-it-is-good basis and when-it-is-needed basis, and that I don't need to be clear on anything most of the time. I can just be content not to know. And I can let the Eternal lead the way on when it's good to be clear on something, when it's good to have insight into something, and when it's not. So that the use of the intellect works into everything, like everything else, into this greater context of entrusting everything into the hands of the Eternal and on turning towards the Eternal for guidance and help. And to do that, you know, one really needs to give up pride of intellect and any other reason why one would cling to it. I've had, over the years, so many senior monks say to me, you know, after all the years, these years of training, and it seems like I really don't know anything. And my answer to that is, well, join the club. We don't need to know anything. All we need to do is have faith and meditate. And when we really need to know something, if we're not blocking, it'll be there. You know, it'll be there. Give the Eternal a chance to get a word in edgeways. This doesn't mean that one doesn't have to sometimes do work with one's brain. Because one does sometimes. Like any other kind of work. And it doesn't take away the difficulty that one sometimes encounters in doing work with one's brain. It takes away the desperation to try to comprehend enlightenment with one's brain, which is impossible. But if I'm trying to learn something new, say I'm trying to learn some words in Dutch, or I'm trying to learn something in mechanical work I'm doing, you know, I still have the same old difficulties I've always had with the brain, with the kind of brain I've got. You know, some things are very difficult for me to, just in a practical sense, to understand. That's not a problem. That's just like any other, like physical difficulties are the same, you know. The thing the brain can't do is take the place of the Eternal. Reverend Massey used to say, the brain is meant to be a computer. It functions like a computer. It gives you a readout of possibilities, a readout of options. Given that there's a readout, well, what's going to choose? How are you going to know which option is the wiser? How are you going to know which option is the more enlightened? Some people say, well, if you give me enough rules and regulations, then I'll always know. I say, phooey. Talk about trying to take the fun out of life. That'll do it. Now, we need some rules and regulations, but that isn't the purpose of them. Other people would say, well, if we have just enough clear formulas for things, you know, then we can just plug in every situation into a formula and we'll have a readout. And I say again, you know, why are we so damned determined to sacrifice our freedom, our essential spiritual freedom, for a little supposed security? When there isn't any real security in it anyway. You know, one of the most wonderful expressions of our innate spiritual freedom is not knowing. So that we're thrown back upon pure faith. You know, and real spiritual courage to take that leap of faith. If you've got the freedom, you might as well make use of it and see it, how magnificent it is, and see how much you're trusted by the Eternal in having that freedom. Learning to really trust the Eternal is just learning to really trust your own true self. Not some external deity. And rules and regulations and formulas don't touch what we're talking about at the deepest level. They don't touch it. And nothing will ever remove the essential risk, the essential adventure that's involved in following the heart, trusting the heart. And it's wrong for people who want to know the truth, live the truth at the deepest level, to look to external things to try to limit the risk and put a damper on the adventure. This is why so many people come to the edge of deeper spirituality and never go into it. because it is scary. That unknowing can be not only uncomfortable, it can be terrifying. I speak of the brain, I speak of that great surrender as a wonderful thing. Well, it is. It's the most wonderful thing in the world. And it's experienced beforehand as you approach it like you're going to die. You cannot believe the terror that can come out of your bowels when you're just, just really a short distance away from it and you don't know what's happening to you. You read Lotus Blossom. Beginning of Lotus Blossom, Ribbon Master says, I am in terror. And boy, I know what that means. When your whole physical and emotional being is scared. Because you're going to let go. You're about to let go, and you don't know. Part of you doesn't know what you're letting go into. What you're going to fall into. Obaku said, I keep quoting it, men are afraid to forget their own mind and to fall through the void, not knowing that the void is the true realm of the Dharmakaya. Once you've let go, then that great flood of the water of the Spirit takes you away with it. And that flood of the water of the Spirit that happens at that time is indescribable. As Rim Master said, it's to be possessed by love beyond our power of comprehension. Then it's whoopee, what a ride. And then you're ready for everything that's going to come in the way of karmic cleanup, which is going to be very intense. And at times, very painful. But then you're being carried and you know it.